Welcome to the inaugural meeting of IDC Conversations Series. Our main guest today needs no introduction. She's a luminary, one of the most notorious figures of the antitrust world and an inspiration to all those who have a special interest in competition law and policy. After being one of the first female partners of a big Wall Street law firm, she became a full-time professor in 1976. She is a member of the IDC's International Advisory Board. She's a Walter Derenberg Professor of Trade Regulation Emerita at the New York University School of Law. She's an expert in antitrust and competition policy, teaches, writes, and advises on competition policy in nations around the world and in international organizations. She has a special interest in developing countries, poverty, inequality, and explores how opening markets and attacking privilege, corruption, and cronyism can alleviate marginalization and open paths to economic opportunity and inclusive development. She received an honorary doctorate degree from the University of Paris Dauphine in 2009. Author of books, articles, case notes, and book reviews on various aspects of international competition law and policy. Today we are having the greatest honor and pleasure of having our IDC conversation with Professor Eleanor Fox. We will co-moderate this meeting together with Ian Forrester, Daniel Francis, and myself, Paolo Trevisan. Ian Forrester is also a member of IDC's International Advisory Board. He was UK's judge at the General Court of the European Union until Brexit between 2015 and 2020. He served as an arbitrator in ICC and ICSID proceedings. He is an honorary Doctor of Laws and honorary professor at the University of Glasgow. He is an advocate to the Scottish Bar, admitted to the English Bar as well as the New York State Bar. He regularly lectures on European law and policy. He's author of numerous articles and chapters on competition law, legal privilege, science and good regulatory practice, trade policy, customs and dumping. Our second co-moderator today is Daniel Francis. Daniel is an assistant professor of law at NYU. He writes and teaches about regulation and competition with a particular interest in dynamic and high-tech markets. Francis previously served at the Federal Trade Commission. He also spent 10 years practicing antitrust law with two multinational law firms in Washington, D.C., New York, and Brussels. He has testified before the Antitrust Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee regarding antitrust policy. Before joining NYU, Francis served as a Clemenceau Fellow at Harvard Law School. And I am Paolo Trevisan, founder and director of the IDC, former commissioner of the Comisión Nacional de Defensa de la Competencia. I am currently a partner at Estudio Trevisan Abogados and professor of competition law at Universidad Católica Argentina, Universidad Austral, among other academic institutions. So, Eleanor, welcome, and again, welcome everybody, and thanks for joining us. Let me shoot with a first question directly. Why competition? Why did you choose antitrust and competition in the first place? What would you tell a student thinking about trying an antitrust or competition course for the first time? And which, if we have time, which would be those best cases to teach fundamentals of competition law to new students?
So thank you very much, Pablo, and thank you, Ian and Daniel. You were really, really kind to invite me on this podcast, and I really appreciate such a wonderful group of questioners. So why did I choose antitrust? You may be surprised to know that antitrust chose me because my first assignment at a big law firm in New York was in antitrust. And that is where I remained and became very, very happy and became more and more happy as I realized the depth and the breadth of the subject antitrust. In fact, in law school, I had one course in antitrust. It was by a professor, Mr. Petro, who actually believed the antitrust laws were unconstitutional. And so antitrust was taught from that angle. It was not something that particularly appealed to me in terms of the way it was intellectually exciting, but not the position that actually appealed to me and appealed to me later in life. As you know, it's not particularly my route into antitrust. So antitrust in my lifetime and in my career actually has changed and developed in very interesting and different ways, because at the time that I started to practice antitrust law, it was socio-political, and then it became very economic. And today there is a pushback that it has become too technocratically economic, with some in some jurisdictions having social values in the law, in others having a conversation that maybe there ought to be some social values in the law other than pure competition. For students that may be thinking of taking antitrust courses or taking antitrust courses for the first time, it is, when they have the right professors like you three, any of you three, it is a very exciting experience. And I do tell my students going into it for the first time, first of all, just go all in, listen, absorb, learn, of course, the cases and the law, but also if they're reading US cases, I would say read carefully those cases at the highest level where there are majority opinions and dissenting opinions. And this actually brings in a kind of richer orientation so that students can understand where they stand and perhaps at some time get a centering in antitrust. What cases do I think are the most useful for teaching the students? There are a lot of them, and they are very interesting, fun cases. So for me, I see Daniel smiling because I have to ask Daniel later, maybe, or maybe now, which he finds the most exciting, as well as most instructive. I love to teach our old Alcoa case, which goes into all of the reasons why you might want or might not want a monopoly law and what it ought to be. I also, going to more modern times, I love teaching the US Microsoft case more than the EU Microsoft cases. And because of the way it postures the issues in a very modern and realistic way, on the cusp of some change, in a highly technological market. And I also love to teach a case I hate, Trinco. Others of you might love it more than I realize, but I love to teach Trinco, our US case, which made a rather right turn in the US law of monopoly and brings out a political philosophy of laissez-faire in the case, but by understanding that political philosophy, one understands the threads of competition law. And for European cases, one case I love is the Irish beef case. It's the only case I know that, because Ireland was promoting the beef cartel in Ireland, in order, because it thought there was an overproduction of beef in Ireland. It's so funny and descriptive of what a, quote, good cartel looks like, what you have to do if you want to be a cartel that lasts, because these cartel members thought that their cartel was authorized by Ireland and therefore they were free to do it in the way that would succeed as a cartel. And then, of course, it also brings in the policy question, a very deep policy question of when government involvement and government encouragement, even government almost order, not quite, should be considered And it also brings into question when you can use a per se rule. So I would use that as my panoply. And one thing I'd just add of what not to teach, the most awful case is a case that most people would think it's such a landmark, it must be wonderful if you haven't read it. And that's the US Standard Oil case of 1911, which is one of the most famous cases in antitrust history. And probably the number one worst case to teach. So when I teach Standard Oil, I have this in my casebook. I have a big excerpt from Matthew Jacobson, and on the robber barons, which goes through all of the acts that Standard Oil did that were thought to be reprehensible, and it's very, very colorful. It is Matthew Josephson.
Thank you very much, Eleanor. Ian, would you like to go through?
Sure. I'm comforted that you didn't express yourself to be a deep fan of the European Microsoft case. That's one can be a connoisseur without being a fan. Anyway, both of us have gray hair, and both of us have observed the ebb and flow of relations between Washington and Brussels in terms of antitrust law, competition law, over the years. I mean, I remember in the 70s and 80s, there were real tensions over jurisdiction, encroachment by these heavy-footed, booted Americans, and then a resolution in the 90s, shared committee, shared goals, positive committee, I should say. And now I think there was a period maybe of 15 years or so when Brussels was the most attractive place to make a radical off-the-wall new argument, which wouldn't appeal to a conservative US district judge in California, but which got picked up and by the European Commission, who ran with it. And now I wonder if the balance is swinging back across the Atlantic. And I just wonder what you think about the wholesome and interesting tension, differences of approach between Washington and Brussels.
So, Ian, that's a really deep question, and I'll make a few comments on it. So there are various ways in which the two jurisdictions are different. My big experience with EU started when I first went there in 1983 forward. So that's where I have most of my knowledge and perceptions from. In the 1980s, there were indeed a lot of tensions between Brussels and Washington. And I believe that Washington treated Brussels very patronizingly for these years, as though they probably didn't know what they were doing, and they should really try to learn US law, and they should absolutely go to school in economics because they just don't know what they're doing. And then the US would go over and make those comments from time to time, but actually it was the little while before the United States began to treat Brussels seriously and began to treat EU law seriously, and even a long time before the US bar began to think, wow, this is a body of law we have to know, rather than simply saying they have to be exactly like us to learn it. And actually, on learning it, I think one might discover that there were some different routes. There are different routes of EU law, routes that definitely extend and are about a common market, making a common integrated market. roots that lead in a very positive way. Ian might agree with me on this one, on condemning state restraints that in the free movement area. Of course, Daniel also very interested in this, I know. The combination and the interrelationship between member state restraints, which were almost always parochial, that prevented the goods and services from going across the borders, and the private restraints, was really a major contribution of the European Union, that those two have to be considered together to get a really free common market. There were other respects in which there are a number of scholars who are of a more libertarian bent who really do not like what EU does, and I'm much more akin to what EU does in terms of the value of open markets, the value of their competition law, that may put more stress on making the barriers lower and what is called opening the market to competition on the merits, rather than looking to see only whether prices are going up to consumers. And this is one thread that is really different about EU law and US law. Of other tensions, oh, and your question about where do you go when you have a rather novel case that you want to bring, do you bring it in Brussels, and has that tide turned? So the answer is, as we saw, like with the Microsoft case and who complained against Microsoft, we saw definitely running to Brussels. I do not think the tide has turned. We're now in the Biden administration. We have antitrust enforcers who are very sympathetic to novel arguments. However, they are under the shadow of the US Supreme Court, which is not sympathetic to novel arguments that would mean more aggressive enforcement, which makes US not the best venue to go for the novel cases. It makes it an interesting place to go, maybe in a short term when you want to bring a merger case with a lot of potential competition issues, and the US might take it up. But I think past this attraction, I think going to Brussels may still be a better payoff for your novel cases.
I mean, just a comment on the judgment last week or in the last days, where one of the points where I think Europe can teach America is the application of competition constraints to the states. And the Commission has been nibbling at generous tax rulings by member states. And there was a big setback last week. Not sure how far that's going to go, but it sounded pretty radical. And an indication, that's a further example, I think, of the point you've been making, that functioning markets require constraints.
Yes. So, yes, the tax and subsidy cases are very interesting to watch. And whether the tax breaks that the countries like Ireland give are a matter of tax policy or antitrust subsidy policy is a very big issue in Europe, which we, of course, we don't have that issue at all today in the US. But it is about state intervention.
Daniel?
So I'd just love to start with a couple of words about what an honor it is and a joy it is to be here celebrating you, Eleanor. Just for those I'm meeting here for the first time, Eleanor has been in my life for about a decade. I met her first through her writing when I began to focus on the relationship between antitrust and the law of free movement in the European Union. And I thought, surely there's nobody out there who has this set of interests that overlap in this peculiar zone. And then I found the work of Professor Eleanor Fox. And then I subsequently met her when I became a doctoral student. Eleanor was kind enough to be on my doctoral committee some years ago. And she became a mentor and a friend and is now a colleague of mine here at NYU. And I just came this morning from teaching the NYU antitrust class this fall. There's more than one person in that room, LLM students, who have come to NYU hoping to learn antitrust from Eleanor Fox and were palpably disappointed when I was the assigned antitrust teacher in the fall instead. But the opportunity to share with them my delight in and admiration for Eleanor's extraordinary body of work across antitrust, free movement law, the relationship between those two and their relationship with international trade, international cooperation, development, and her extraordinary legacy of teaching here is just one of the great joys. And just as a measure of her influence on me, last night I taught a 1L reading group session on monopoly and monopolization, and I gave them just two cases to read. One was Alcoa and one was Microsoft.
Oh, really?
Wonderful two-hour discussion in all the ways you just outlined, Eleanor. So everything that I do here at NYU in the antitrust bubble is a very humble tribute to the extraordinary set of landmarks that you've erected. But I want to follow up on...
First of all, Daniel, you were much too kind, and it's all my honor, and I was so honored to be on your dissertation committee and everything else, and greatly honored to have you as my colleague, which is terrific, so thank you. All right, questions?
So I want to pick up on the last strand of your exchange with Ian, because so many now of antitrust's deep questions touch on the relationship not just between our regulation of conduct by private businesses, but also choices of the state more generally. And the political projects that we're more accustomed to thinking about through the lens of constitutional law, administrative law, are increasingly tangled with antitrust. And what used to be a technocratic conversation, as you put it earlier, is now a much more inclusive, much more politically pluralistic one. And I think there's a lot to celebrate about that. But I wonder if I could start, Eleanor, just by asking you this. How much politics and democracy do you think we want in competition policy and enforcement? This is a moment where antitrust, particularly in the United States, but also around the world, is having a deep reckoning with very important popular and sometimes populist and democratic currents of opinion that bear sometimes pretty sharply on some of the work antitrust has to, you know, do to get through the day, whether we're talking about merger enforcement, conduct cases, policy, definition of what it means to have an unfair method of competition. But at the same time, we recognize that antitrust choices often have implications that might not be immediately apparent to the public as a whole. So from your perspective, bringing your extraordinary combination of interests and knowledge in democracy, political development, the role of the state, competition and competition policy, how much room do we want to make inside antitrust for democracy and popular politics?
Wow, that's a really great question and so relevant today. So I would say this first about democracy and competition law, that the two are symbiotic. And the competition law is pursuing its goals of making markets work better. And it has to be on track of pursuing its goals with more democracy as an output, as a byproduct of it. And so you're referring, of course, to the circumstance today in the United States in particular today, because this is, in a sense, it's a very US question, but it also relates to the whole world. So in the US, the big thing of the last 8 years is that there has been a populist, this is not the negative hating populist, this is the for the people populist, that a populist movement arose saying basically, markets aren't working for us, and antitrust is supposed to make them work for us, and antitrust isn't working. And we've got to revolutionize antitrust to make the markets work for us and not for the elites. Part of this picture is saying that we see markets working for the elites, and those people who are better off get better off, and those people who are poorer or even middle class are not getting a fair share of the gains. So should antitrust react to that? That's basically what I see as your question. Should antitrust react to that and take it on board? Well, as a matter of fact, the Biden administration does react to it and has taken on board and has appointed heads of competition who actually believe that narrative. But how much can they do? And how much should they try to mold antitrust to respond to, let's call it, the people? And my view is that it's actually, there's a limited amount, that there's an important amount of listening, but there's a limited amount that antitrust can do and a very limited amount that it can do to change trajectories where people who are the 1% are getting a great share of the gains of trade. But I think that this has happened in the United States, that that movement, which in the United States is called the neo-Brandeis movement, that that movement has actually fit into a picture where many, many people, and not just populists, believe that U.S. antitrust has been enforced in a way that's too narrow. They've let too many big mergers go by that are harmful to competition, markets, and consumers, and that antitrust law therefore should be much more aggressive. It also fits into a narrative, and if you hear me, you're seeing I'm really talking about markets. I'm not talking about other values that you might want to preserve. I'm talking about markets working well for all the people it's supposed to work for, and consumers are the best proxy, but they're not the only ones. And that leads me into the rest of this. I think that this pushing of the neo-Brandeis narrative has also opened up thinking in the United States that consumers are not the only beneficiary of markets, and they're not the only beneficiary of a law that says no boycotts and no cartels. There can be a cartel against suppliers. There can be a cartel against workers. And this we've found is really common, that different employers get together and they agree not to steal one another's employees, and they agree to push the prices down of the employees. Well, that's a labor market. It is a market. So the whole neo-Brandeis gestalt has opened up the idea that maybe we should look at the more dynamics of the market rather than simply what might be called efficiency outcomes of certain conduct. In that sense, I think antitrust can become more accountable without saying, yeah, we're with Occupy Wall Street. It's really saying, we believe in markets, and there's room for competition to do more work to keep them going well.
That's a lovely way to frame it. I hear you saying something like antitrust can shift its center of gravity in response to messages that it gets back from the community it's answerable to, right? Like if it's been inattentive to workers, then it can shift back in that direction. If it's been, you know, acting in a way that makes us think the overall intensity of antitrust is too lax for its social function, then it can lean forward. So we're not necessarily talking about occupying Wall Street or turning doctrine on its head, but responding in deeper structural ways. And that strikes me as very persuasive. I wonder if I can take you away from U.S. antitrust and on a voyage to another of what I know as your great loves, which is the project of economic integration. And in particular, I want to ask you, I know that a project that is extremely close to your heart and which is a big focus of your attention at the minute is African economic integration. And I wonder if I could just invite you to reflect with us about what you see as the differences between the project of economic integration for Africa, and that other great example of regional integration, the European Union. I realize that we're in, you know, a moment where the opportunities for African countries are presented by economic integration are vast and extremely tempting. And of course, there's a sort of naive comparativism that says, oh, we should just look at the European example and, you know, that'll give us a blueprint for moving forward. But the kind of comparativism that, you know, you've made the subject of your career tells us that that's too much too fast, and that a subtler perspective is likely to be a surer guide. So what, if anything, can African economic integration learn or derive from the European example? In what ways do you think it's different?
Right. So thank you for that. And let me just say, so everyone's on the same page, that if you don't know, the African Union has presented and there has been adopted an African free trade agreement. And there is already for a couple of years, a protocol on free movement. And they are now negotiating a protocol for all of Africa for competition law. And so the questions that you are raising, Daniel, arise in this context, which is what should be the design of a competition law for Africa? And so this is a very fraught question. How much can a competition law at the center do? Can it do anything? What can it do? So the African Free Trade Agreement, which refers to there will be negotiation of the competition protocol, says that is because of its value in integrating Africa. And this is a big question. Can competition law in the center integrate Africa? This has led me to think very much about the EU institutional model, and not just the competition, but very much the institutional model of free movement, so that member states cannot take action of their law. They cannot pass laws that will obstruct the free movement without justification across borders. Africa has a huge problem in this regard. And there are many similarities. Of course, there are many differences, but there are many similarities about the project in Africa to have using competition law to help integrate Africa. And going back to the early 1950s, when there was the discussion and then, of course, the adoption of the European communities to use competition law as part of its picture to have an integrated European community. There are differences and similarities about the sovereignty and the jealousness of the sovereignty of the member states. And in Europe, the member states had such a strong incentive to have one Europe that they were willing, and Germany was willing, to give up some of that sovereignty to get peace in Europe. Africa does not have anything like that incentive. And the member states are very jealous of their sovereignty. And the African Free Trade Agreement is looking forward to a common market. It's not a common market yet, but to go on the track of free trade agreement to common market, the member states have to give up a little sovereignty. And sometimes more than a little sovereignty, they have to give up nationalistic policies. When I started to think about competition policy for the center, this is what I thought: that Africa could adopt something that looks like competition policy according to all of the best international standards and apply it business as usual, and there's no better integration of Africa. And then it would fail for that principal reason of integrating Africa. And what I decided, or at least tentatively, was that there are such big border barriers in Africa between and among the member states that unless the competition authority works with the free movement directorate in Africa and identifies what are the barriers that are keeping the member states balkanized, and tears them down, whether it's more on the trade side or more on the competition side, but zeroes in on those barriers that are not letting the goods flow across the border, unless they do that, competition law might have some very good aspects, but it won't be integrating Africa. And just a word or two more in this direction. I do believe there's more room, not just in Africa, but maybe elsewhere, well, many different places, for catching combination of vested interests that they might bribe governments, they might work with governments who have regulations that play into their hands and against that are artificially playing into their hands, making it unlikely that anybody else will come across the border. There are so many of these obstructions that are below a radar screen, and I think there has to be more research on it. In the University of Johannesburg, there is a research group called CRED. Some of you may know, and you might know Simon Roberts and Tando Villacasa, who are working in this area of getting data where they believe that the trade flows across and not across neighbors' borders are so suspicious, something's going on. It could be just a private cartel. It is more likely, because there's so many examples of government involvement, the member state involvement, some of it corrupt, some of it not. And getting the data to find out exactly what's happening, and if the law now doesn't take care of it, to mold a new trade and competition violation to attack those restraints. Of course, this is not going to happen in Africa, and certainly not going to happen soon. It's just my idea of what would really be a good competition measure in Africa would be focusing on this particular problem of hybrids, private-public restraints, and trying to attack them.
And that'd be a beautiful project to move ahead.
Oh, anybody wants to get on board this project, it's very difficult because I'm suggesting a new violation. It's a trade competition violation. It's in an area where I'm saying we have silos because of past dependency, where each group doesn't listen to the other, and not my problem, not my problem. And they don't catch what is, I wrote a little article on this called The Blind Spot. They just don't catch it. It hasn't been published yet. I'll send it to you.
That'd be wonderful. Ian.
I'd like to pursue in a sense what you've just been talking about another enforcement problem. And that is, I was in a country, actually a Western European country, not quite Western, a country in the European continent, where the banks increased their interest rates in the course of a week by the same amount. So that was obviously a cartel. And the minister instructed the head of the competition authority to go and change things. So I guess that in Africa and other countries too, what you might call ministerial capture or capture of enforcement activity, closing down your rival's business, your electoral rival's business using the competition laws must be tempting. Have you experience of that? And I just wonder how you persuade your interlocutors.
So a minister with too much power in this area is dangerous for the reasons you've said. And I actually, the minister I know best is the minister in South Africa. And fortunately, he is not corrupt and he is very interested in making the African markets work and be more inclusive. He does take various actions that you would perhaps criticize as too equality oriented, and they may not be along the line of rule of law, antitrust, and that's a criticism. But the big thing is he's not corrupt and he's really working for Africa. But the next minister might not fit that mold. Mm-hmm. And this is a huge problem, that a minister will be cronyistic, can have huge amounts of room to be cronyistic and privilege giving. And that aspect of many countries, and especially developing countries, that you have cronyism, you have families, a few families own all of the big businesses and they work together with the government, and then ministers work together and each lines their own pockets. That's a huge barrier to competition. So my only advice would be try to get good institutional structure and good law and good judges. And that is also in the same countries, it's usually not even possible.
Yes.
So I don't have a good answer for you, except to work on that line of rule of law, good judges, and cabining the discretion of ministers.
Well, let me pursue that question. My own views are, no, it's related to it. I used to go to court and provide all the arguments. If you side with, if you agree with me, then you're consistent with your precedents, with a little bit of stretching. You're being economically fair. There's all these moral advantages or merits, and economically the world would be better off. And what a dreadful decision was made, which is under appeal. And then sitting as a judge, I realized that from time to time, quite often, the competition authority is making what you might call, Mr. Leitenberger calls, a normative choice. So are hybrid cars in the same market as electric cars? And there will be 6 studies on one side, 10 studies on the other, weighing 20 kilos in total, saying yes and saying no. So the authority can perfectly credibly say, no, they're in different markets, or they're in the same market. And when I was sitting as a judge, I found it sometimes, and in retrospect, maybe I should have found it more often, that we were tempted to substitute our own conclusions for those of the European institutions. Now, we did it by finding a logical flaw. You didn't, in the documents that you studied, the Green Report Annex A, paragraph 57, was not mentioned. And so we look for a logical flaw, oops, that justifies us in overturning. But we didn't really ask ourselves, and maybe we couldn't ask ourselves, was the authority entitled to make that decision? And was it really so wrong that we have to intervene? So that's a long, wordy question, and it's about the limits of judicial review. And I'm really not sure where we should be.
This is a very hard question as to when is the body entitled to make a decision, and then the question of review. So I find in the United States, our courts take on more of the scope of, yes, they can review, even though policy was made by an expert agency below, and even though they were entitled to do it. So there's so many variations of your question. Our Federal Trade Commission has just come out with a policy statement on use of unfair methods of competition, and they've outlined what they think would be a plan for using our Federal Trade Commission Act much more aggressively than it has been used under certain principles. Are they entitled to make this decision? And when they make the decision, and within what limits? And when they make the decision, how much can be reviewed by the court? These are both going to be in, these questions are going to be in court. I find in many developing countries that there are not good, reliable courts. And partly as a result of that, there's more discretion left in the agency to make the decisions as to how to interpret their law. But the question of are they entitled to make the decision, I think you have to look at the law. And a lot of the social issues that are now being pulled into antitrust come into that category, like is EU entitled to make a decision that an agreement which does lessen competition is good for the environment?
Yes, yes.
Is it?
Pass. I'm disappointed often to read judgments which are dreadfully long and which, although the examination is really careful, I know because I've done it, the quality of the judgment is a bit variable in that it spends an awful lot of time on matters which are not really crucial. And the core, the reason, the key paragraph may well be a criticism of the formal logic rather than a position on the substance, the real substance. And I would guess that when it's can you link the environment and competition considerations, yeah, probably that's quite fashionable. That's probably quite, that's probably okay.
It is fashionable. This goes to Daniel's question earlier about it's popularly, that's what fashionable is. It's very popular today in view of the great threat of the environment degradation. So yeah. It's very popular, and EU seems pushed to find ways to at least recognize arguments about environment. And in terms of the length of the agreement, Ian, do you think that EU could possibly change course and go to a shorter form of decisions and judgments?
There's a dreadful ravening dragon which has slaughtered much paper and done much damage, the Brexit monster. And the departure of UK members from the court has, I think, necessarily set back some of the British pragmatism, which the court doesn't renounce in any way, but it's a court of 27 people, very different backgrounds. So I would imagine that the court isn't going to become less continental in its approach until Scotland comes back as an independent member state, but that's not certain.
Sorry, let me jump in from South America. I'm trying to go back to some of the ideas you've mentioned, Eleanor, as well as Daniel and Ian. By the way, I think Ian has recently wrote a paper on some of these Brexit issues that you've already mentioned. I would invite everybody to read that. I don't know if that's already published or not, but it's a very interesting piece of how Brexit has some effects on what we are talking about today here. So, but I mean, Let me take you a little bit back to, you mentioned, Eleanor, that consumers are not, and I put it down, the only beneficiaries of antitrust. And you mentioned workers, labor markets. We've talked about sustainability issues, populism, populists, movements. But when we listen to the commentators, academics, many people are talking about trade-offs. And I remember a couple of months ago, we were at Fordham in a conference, and I mentioned the compatibility among these issues. Where would you be, if anywhere, where would you, in which side of the story would be you? Would you on this sort of trade-offs with these social values or compatibility? I don't know if that's correctly put it. And then related with that, I'm going to make a second question on the same question. Is there only one standard? Because you've mentioned consumers are not the only beneficiaries. We have been discussing for the last years on should we retain, reform, or should we replace the consumer welfare standard? So is there only one standard, really? So should we replace, retain, restore? Or is it more like, at least in the US, where I'm not, I'm just an outside, I analyze from the outside, but I mean, it's more like there are more like inflection points on specific decisions that I may have had some focus on fact-based opinions. So, I mean, is there one standard? And related with the previous one, I don't know if I made it clear, but I mean, I have two questions in one, but I think they're very related with all
yes. Yes, they're very related. And let me answer it this way. And let me take it from the United States first, but this applies much more than the United States. There is one point of view, and in the United States, it's usually called the consumer welfare standard, but it is about markets. It's not statically only consumers. It is about either making markets work or not letting firms put impediments in markets so that they don't work, so that market power is used and the markets don't work. And that is a dynamic market concept. Some people call it market process. When consumer welfare is used, it's a huge tent. It means different things to different people. So the far right, it really means allocative efficiency and whether there's output restraint. And to those that go more left, but not yet neo-Brandeis, because they're still saying this is market. It's the competition law is about markets. It's not about anything else. So this left that's not yet neo-Brandeis is using the word consumer welfare, but they're really meaning what I said about making markets work better, removing impediments, not letting firms put impediments in the way by exacerbating market power. All of those people sometimes like to keep together under the rubric of consumer welfare because their common point is they don't want social values in competition law. Not that they're against social values. Some of them are very ardently for social values, but they don't want to undermine or weaken what competition law does best. And they don't want to bring into competition law duties that they think competition law really can't do at all. And then I bring in now neo-Brandeis. And that is where you get your trade-offs. That you could, but you don't have to. You could go in a direction of saying, I want to protect small business, even if it means prices are higher. And that's a trade-off. And I think that agencies ought to recognize much more than they do. They almost never do. That there are trade-offs if they go in that direction and bring in certain social values. It might be a social value for environment. I think most agencies will realize when firms say, oh, I really want to do this, it's great for the environment. It isn't. They want to make more money. They could protect the environment just as well without it. I know agencies are usually skeptical about those claims, but still there is an area of claim where the agency wants to listen and may, like the Dutch and the Greek in their guidelines, they're willing to make a trade-off. So I think that there is one. So going back to not including Neo Brandeis, I think there is one goal, although, and that is about making markets work or preventing impediments by use of market power. People disagree as to what is market power and how vibrant it is and whether the market will work to push it back. But there is that one goal. And then when you get to Neo Brandeis, they also share that goal. And a huge amount of what they are doing is, in their view, making the market work better rather than going into the trade-off area. And some of what they're doing is going into the trade-off area.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there any questions from the audience before we, so we don't monopolize between Ian, Daniel, and myself? Because if there's no other questions, I think we need to sort of wrap up. Maybe a couple of last questions from Ian and Daniel. We're reaching the hour now.
Okay. Well, I would like, if unless someone has shown, no. Okay. You've been a practitioner and you're most famous as a teacher and a philosopher. If you had been an advocate full-time, which would be the nicest case to have argued, and which side would you have been?
In any country, right?
Yes.
Yes.
You're a citizen of the world, antitrust-wise.
Yes. Well, I actually would have liked to have argued the Trinco case in the U.S. on the side of the plaintiff, who actually didn't have standing, and that made it a mess in a way. But supposing you have a good plaintiff with good standing, the electric company, the incumbent electric company, had actually made it more difficult for the entrants to get good service from the local loop. They had put noise into the system. The Supreme Court did not even mention this fact, but it's very much in the other opinions, the District Court and the Second Circuit. And I think there are certain kinds of conduct that can be separated out and say, no, you're the incumbent, you just can't do this. It was found by the FCC. They purposely put noise into the signals that the new entrants were getting so that they wouldn't take away their business. Such a simple proposition. And maybe a companion case to argue for some simple propositions would be our case, California Dental, where the dentist's bylaws, so their trade association, their cartel says, no, you can't advertise and you can't advertise price unless you put in it the whole telephone book, and therefore you can't advertise it because it's too many words. So you can't advertise price, and you can't even say to people, I have a reasonable price or good service or gentle service. Those kinds of cases should be simple propositions, and there should be a list of things like that that companies can't do. But given our system today, we don't have simple rules. So that was my point I was segueing into. I would like to be able to try to establish there can be some simple rules, not bogged down by turning over every stone and letting defendants play out every single argument that takes millions of dollars, so cases do get decided.
Eleanor, I wonder if I can ask you to wrap up our discussion on what I hope will be an optimistic note. As you think about antitrust 25 or even 50 years from now, world antitrust, right? Competition policy and antitrust enforcement as this great shared global endeavor. In 2072, in half a century's time, what do you hope will be different?
So What a great question, for which I will not be here. But let me say this. I mean, my example is going to be mega mergers that hurt the whole world, that we've got to find a route to take care of global problems with a global vision of where are all the costs and all the benefits and all the harms. And we don't now have anywhere near such a route. And that's got to be wrong. So you have a mega merger in each country, handles it and looks at its own citizens and then says, oh, if it hurts foreigners, that's fine. It's not my problem. And transactions that should be stopped don't get stopped. There could be something the other way around, where if you look at it on a global scale, maybe parts of big tech business, you want to say, we shouldn't stop, we should let them do this. We do not have a grasp at the pinnacle where we should be looking from. And so in 2070, I hope that nations' competition agencies will be able to come together in a way where they're not only protecting their own citizens, but getting a global view of what this problem is and what is the good common solution. And then they can go home and use their own law. They don't have to have an international law, but the global problem is not taken care of today. And I think there ought to be think tanks that move us better towards this.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Daniel, Ian, Eleanor. I think we could stay for not hours, but days here. Honestly, yeah. It's been a pleasure and a lot of fun. Before we close, do you have any closing remarks, Eleanor, that you maybe want to share with all of us?
So the closing remark would be, I'm just so honored to be in the company of the three of you. And I kept feeling I wanted to ask you for answers to all of these questions. So maybe a next time. And you're very gracious and wonderful. And thank you.
Well, our pleasure. Thank you. Thank you very much, Eleanor. It was a pleasure for us, for the IDC especially.
Yes.
Thank you, Ian, again. And Daniel, it's a pleasure to have you on board. And thanks, everybody. Thanks for all who joined. It's been really a very nice event. Yes. And we're very, very happy to have had this chance with Eleanor. Ian, Daniel, anything else?
This is delightful. I really regret that Eleanor and I and the rest of us have not been having 3 monthly chats on these subjects. And I'm sure that if we could bottle them, we could make a fortune.
Well, that to that is, Eleanor, it's an honor to be your colleague and friend, but I think like the rest of the antitrust world, I and we all will always be your student in so many ways. And thank you for giving us the opportunity to share this occasion with you.
Thank you, and it's vice versa. Okay, thank you.
Amen. Okay, thank you very much, and see you next time.
With pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Eleanor.
Bye-bye. Nice to see you.
Thanks so much. That was good fun.